Ed is our special guest for tonight, and you've brought with you your wife Sarah. Is she somewhere?
Yes, she's
Sarah. And you've got two kids as well. Have you forgotten them? Where are they?
Like my two kids are at home. My two kids are aged seven and nearly seven and five, Eva and Daisy, and they are at home with Sarah's mum actually. And home is Bristol.
Bristol. Okay, yeah. That's a really sweet age.
Yeah,
5 year old, 7 year old girls.
They're sweet most of the time. Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah. When they're sweet, they're very sweet.
Yeah, they are.
And when they're not,
they're delightful.
Understood. So tonight you are sitting under a huge banner that says anxiety and depression, and you're the poster boy for it. So how does that feel?
I'll be honest, it stings a bit. The talk on sensational success, that was last week, but no one turned up. It's real. It feels slightly uncomfortable if I'm honest. But that's part of the reason why I'm here talking tonight.
Well, it's amazing that you've opened yourself up to it, and you have said that I'm allowed to be nosy tonight, mm-hmm. can't I? I can mm-hmm. be on. It's on their behalf. They're the nosy ones, really. I'm just asking the questions that they're too timid to ask because I'm Australian, so I'll just be, you know, I'll just be rude.
That's fine. You have permission.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. So you've got permission. So I'm not just being rude, but it's quite a thing to open yourself up like this. Why do it? Why talk about such a deep and personal trauma?
I guess there is something quite enchanting actually about having a group of people listening into what I'm about to say. But as I said, I'd rather it was about sensational success than anxiety and depression. I think the reason why I'm willing to be open and talk about it is because I think there is there's still a kind of a culture of fear and shame almost when it comes to talking about mental health challenges. I think particularly among men. I mean, I'm sure it applies to women as well, but particularly among men, we're not quite there in terms of being able to be open about it. So if me sitting here in front of you can kind of help support that openness, that change of culture where it's acceptable to talk about mental health, then that's
awesome.
Okay. Yeah.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's awesome. Because I do think that openness begets openness and honesty begets honesty. And I think we'll all be much the richer. Even though we're listening to your story, I think all of us will resonate on some levels with your story, and all of us will think, ah, yeah, I know how you got there.
Yeah.
And there are things that correspond in all of our own lives with the story that you're going to tell. But let's go back to the beginning. Let's start off with childhood, happy childhood.
Yeah. I grew up in a fairly normal home.
Whereabouts?
Plymouth.
Yep.
Down in the southwest. I am the eldest of three brothers.
Okay.
It was a happy childhood.
Yeah, and faith has played some part in your journey. We'll sort of get onto that. But was it sort of a church going home? Was that part of growing up?
Yeah, my parents took me to church, mm-hmm. Took us to church when we were young. Mm. And that was probably a tradition that I continued through university. I think we're going to talk more later on about post-university and stuff. But yeah, so I grew up going to church. I wouldn't necessarily say that I was, that I saw the point of it. But yeah, grew up going to church.
Yeah. And in terms of this topic of anxiety and depression, can you look back on your, I don't know, 9-year-old self, 10-year-old, can you look back on Ed as a child and see some of those kind of issues in bud form?
Yes. My childhood was happy, but it was also overshadowed, I suppose, with circumstances within the family, which I didn't really, wouldn't necessarily have. I don't remember sort of being particularly aware of, overtly aware. But I was subconsciously always aware that my mum had cancer from the time that just before I was born, and lived for some 30 years, so routinely every 8 years or so needing big operations. I can look back, and I have looked back with the help of counsellors, therapists, on the impact that growing up with a mother who was seriously ill, that has had a bearing on my mental health, I suppose.
What do you think it does to a young boy? Mum is sick. I can't do anything to control that. That would be a catastrophic thing. You know, that's almost a world-ending possibility. My mother might die. How does that impact your thought life? How does that impact your anxieties? What's going on as a young boy dealing with that?
I didn't really consciously think about it, I don't think, or I don't remember consciously thinking about it as a young boy. I think the some of the ingrained thought patterns that I've grown up with and have kind of therefore kind of modelled onto current life or adulthood, I suppose, are that that I do need to control things. that I do need to control things, and that if things go wrong, then it could have catastrophic consequences.
Yes.
Which of course is not the case. But
it's a huge sort of shadow that it casts itself across you. But I'm guessing growing up you're quite good at school. Is that what you
said? Yeah, I was very good at school.
I was guessing you were going to say that as well. So, what were you particularly good at? Go on, tell us.
Well, I was good at being good, as in well behaved.
Right.
That's the kind.
Okay. You're a good boy.
I was a good boy. I just remember everyone, all of. My parents' friends would always comment that aren't your three boys so well behaved, and they'd be thinking, well, yeah, they are when they're out. when we're back home, it's less we're less well behaved. Academically, I was all right.
Yes.
Did okay with my GCSEs and my A-levels and stuff.
Yes. And then off to university?
That? Went to university at Bath. Mm-hmm. Studied French and French and business.
So if I had parachuted into your life age sort of 18, and you've mm-hmm. just you've just gone off to Bath University, mm-hmm. You've left home, a church-going home, mm-hmm. but it's not exactly a faith that you've owned for yourself. Mm-hmm. Ed, aged 18, what did he make of Jesus?
Ed, aged 18, had an intellectual understanding of who Jesus was. Mm-hmm. Probably quite a strong moral compass, and therefore kind of a desire to conform and behave, equally kind of wanted to keep it at arm's length so it wasn't too, like it was too, didn't really want to kind of let it in too much. It was a bit serious, a bit kind of,
yes,
bit
Would it be a bit about losing control a bit?
I suppose, yeah, thinking about it that way, yeah, it could have been. But also, I mean, amongst a peer group, a friendship group who didn't, who had no interest, it was kind of like, well, you know, I'd rather blend in with my mates, rather do what they're doing. I don't really want to let this thing kind of interrupt my life too much.
So what do you do with a degree in French and business from Bath University?
You join TfL, Transport for London.
Transport for London?
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
It's a well-worn career path, I'm sure. Okay.
I actually spent 2 years after university trying to work out what it was that I did want to do, during which time I did a bit of travelling and a bit of temping work, working for Plymouth City Council, which was riveting.
Is it as glamorous as it sounds?
Yeah, it's great. Very glamorous.
Okay.
And then I joined TfL on a graduate scheme, which was all about project management and roadworks. Which is obviously
it
what
just
you
gets
do
more and more rock and roll, doesn't it?
With a French degree. Yeah.
The glamorous life of Ed Watson. Okay.
Yes,
but I mean that sounds quite high pressured. Project management, Transport for London. You're dealing with lots of different agencies, lots of different deadlines approaching. Am I getting that? What's the sense of working for TfL?
Yeah. I guess. Yeah. So the bit that I worked for was all about roadworks, and when you work in roadworks, you're never popular. You know, no one likes roadworks, right? And I've always been, I think, very ambitious and driven, and kind of wanted to do everything kind of much better than everyone else, and just, you know. Bit, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say I'm career driven. I just want to do a brilliant job.
Just driven. Yeah.
Why wouldn't you do a great job if you can? To your question, was working at TfL high pressure? Yes. I think a lot of the pressure was self driven. Wanting to make sure that I was keeping control of the roadworks, and Richmond's affluent stakeholders and residents.
Right.
It was high pressure. Yeah.
And it was at this point, wasn't it, the sort of the anxiety and depression sort of really started to kick in, was it?
Yeah, my first kind of real experience of anxiety and depression happened around 2010, 2012, around that kind of time. Ten years ago.
Yeah.
But yeah, 10 years ago.
How bad did it get?
Quite bad. Bad enough for me to be bad enough for me to find myself on the kitchen floor, sort of in tears, with a knife against my wrist, sort of just wanting it to go away, wanting it to stop.
What is it?
The anxiety. The feeling of despair, empty sort of sense of emptiness, and just kind of black nothingness, and you know, if that means life, then I just wanted it to stop.
And nothing was switching that feeling off.
No.
What were you trying in terms of, I mean, there's lots of things in those situations, you try this, you try that, it doesn't work. What was it that wasn't working?
Well, nothing was working. Thinking my way out of it. couldn't understand why I was. I both couldn't understand and was also livid with the fact that I felt anxious because I was so angry because I didn't want to feel anxious.
Should we go back to coming out of university? You had this faith that was not really yours. Mm-hmm. It was sort of an inherited thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was a parental thing. You'd been church going. You'd kept this Jesus figure at kind of arm's length. But you were saying to me earlier, there was a bit of a spiritual journey because, you know, we'll bring these two things together. We've got the anxiety and depression thing, but there's also this faith element that's been very important to your story. So let's come at it this way. What was it that was commending Jesus to you? What was it that was compelling about Jesus and making you own for yourself a faith that previously had been a childhood thing?
So I guess it's probably worth saying the feelings of anxiety and depression weren't the kind of trigger where I said, oh, okay, I'll, all right then, Jesus. I'll,
no, right.
Long story short, but after university was the time that I decided to own it. Hmm. It being a relationship with Jesus for myself. Mm. And which I suppose kind of equipped me with kind of the basic foundations of being able to deal and rationalize feelings of anxiety and depression when it came on in around 2010. I'd want to point out that it in no way was Jesus or Christianity kind of a quick fix, like,
right.
Okay, it's fine. Mm-hmm. Oh, I forgot.
Jesus and his magic wand.
There we are.
Ding.
That's the answer. Yeah. But it has helped, is helping to make sense of I suppose the darkness that that I felt in the pit of my stomach.
Well, let's figure out how he does that in a second. Let's first figure out how did you go from Jesus at arm's length to thinking, "Oh, Jesus is Lord. He's great. He's tops." Like, what shifts your thinking about Jesus himself? And then we'll think about how Jesus kind of interacts with that. But what is it that's changing your thinking about Jesus himself?
Okay, so that story is really round. After university, me and spending time in Plymouth, working in the glamorous city council, where a friend of mine got alongside me, who is a Christian, said, "Why don't we read the Bible together?" And I think we did read the Bible. We also read a couple of books about Jesus and about God. They were God's Big Picture by Vaughan Roberts and Knowing God by a bloke called Jim Packer, which is a big, chunky, quite hard to understand book. And me and him and one other bloke actually used to get together at 6:30 on a Wednesday morning, having promised to earnestly to read at least two chapters of the book, and then discuss them over a bacon sandwich and a coffee.
Okay.
And it was through that friend and those early morning meetings and chats that I decided that the weight of evidence was sufficient for me to own the relationship with Jesus. I.e., it wasn't. I'd got to a point where I was thinking, okay, this is a little bit silly, me going to church out of habit, out of tradition, because frankly, I have loads of other stuff that I could be doing. So either this is true and it's worth being wholehearted about, or it's false and I'll go and do something else because it's right. I'm going to stop the tradition thing because it's silly. And it was those discussions and those two books that led me to believe that the evidence was there. Not that I understood it all, and I still don't understand it all, but there was enough evidence to say, yeah, okay, this is true, and therefore it's worth following.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great. So Jesus is now a big part of your life, but also, as the story develops, anxiety and depression becomes a big part of your life. And we've thought about the things that haven't worked in terms of, you know, you can't just snap out of it. You can't just tell yourself, don't worry. It's nothing you can think your way out of. In fact, your thinking becomes the prison that you're trapped in. You can't get out of your own head.
Yeah.
To the point where you want to do things to end the pain.
Yeah.
So how do you get out of, like, such a slump? When we think about 2010, when we think about 2012, you were in a deep, dark pit. How on earth do you get out of that pit?
So I think the it kind of begun with slowly accepting that that something was wrong. And that that I needed help, that I couldn't think my way out of it, and it wouldn't just go away. And as much as I was kind of really angry that and adamant that there was nothing wrong, because that was the kind of circle in my head, like a kind of. I can't even describe how I felt, but just wretched. But yet there was nothing wrong, and I couldn't. And that's kind of two statements that just don't reconcile. And it was doing my head in that there's nothing wrong with me, but there is something wrong with me,
right.
And I can't fix it. And I and running in. As fast as I can, for as long as I can, won't get rid of it, and I can't think my way out of it, and I can't. Well, there's nothing I can do. So, sorry, your question was what did help? I suppose the first thing was just accepting that. Okay, fine. There's something wrong, and then a few things. Having having loving support and friends and family.
You're not alone in it.
Yeah. That was important. Eventually, when kind of I reluctantly accepted, or reluctantly went further to accept, okay, all right, there is something wrong. Okay, I'll take medication. The medication helped, and also therapy, counselling. That has helped, and those three things. Have helped. I've also read extensively about it, trying to understand. Kind of, I was going from book to book, trying to get the answer, and none of them had the answer, but a combination of the books and talking to counselors, talking to friends, has helped me kind of rationalize it and understand it a bit. I think it's worth saying that, coming back to one of your first questions, or why on earth am I sitting here telling everyone about this? I suppose one of the things that I really, really, really longed for, and couldn't find, didn't have, was
sort of others to articulate what you're articulating now.
But specifically, someone who I could identify with, a bloke,
yes,
was ambitious and driven, and was always endeavouring to do stuff well. Someone in a professional services environment. After Transport for London, I spent 4 years in management consulting, which equally is kind of, or more so, is high pressure, and kind of you're expected to perform. You're expected to be Superman, as one of my clients told me. I'm not saying that there weren't public examples of people who were suffering with anxiety and depression, but I couldn't find anyone who I could relate to, who I could identify with, who said, "Yeah, do you know, it's fine. It's okay.
Right.
It's not the be all and it's not the end. It's
right.
It's okay.
Right. You need a friend to accompany you in this, to share the burden, to suffer alongside, and to say, I've been here before, I know the way out." You know, that's hugely important, and that's why I think you're very brave for doing what you're doing tonight, because you could be that voice for others right here.
Part of being able to rationalize what on earth the purpose is of me not being able to think, when I pride myself on my ability to think and I get paid for thinking. So what on earth is the purpose of me suffering with anxiety and depression? If it means that through me sitting here and speaking to other people about it, if that helps in whatever way, then that helps to kind of make sense of it.
You talk about purpose in the context of something that feels as chaotic as anxiety and depression feel. In some ways, does it make things worse to be a Christian? Does it make things worse, in some sense, to feel like, I'm in this pit, it feels like everything's out of control, but there's this book over here called the Bible that says someone is. Mm. Well, he's not doing a great job of showing up, is he? Mm. I mean, those thoughts must come to mind, mustn't they? Like,
yeah. I distinctly remember quite vividly sitting on the lounge floor with Sarah there, my wife, and Liz, this was I was living in London at the time, and kind of really being quite angry, because I couldn't understand what the flipping heck was the purpose of. Yeah, I didn't want to be anxious, and I wasn't really prepared at that time to accept that there was anything wrong, and I knew there wasn't. I knew logically there's no point in being anxious. Why do I feel anxious? I don't want to feel anxious, and being quite angry that if God's in control, and if I think Liz was telling me that God is in control and God has got a purpose for this, and I was saying, well, what the flipping heck is the purpose of this? Because he's not really listening to me, is he? Because I've asked him to take it away, and he hasn't.
Mm. Yeah. Which is part of what I mean by, in some senses, there is a God of love out there. It sounds like a lovely idea, and it is a lovely idea, and it's a truth. But when you're not feeling it, it can almost feel like a taunt, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's where I say it's not a quick fix.
Right.
Kind of, it's not wave your magic wand, magic Jesus wand, and it
right.
and it all gets better.
Right.
You know, having read the evidence, and nothing in the Bible says it's a magic wand.
No.
It doesn't say that there's there won't be any hurt, and there won't be right. any darkness,
right.
and there won't be any sadness and no. difficulty.
It promises those things, actually. But if it's not a magic wand, what is it? Because I think you've very helpfully laid out for us some of the medical helps that you can get. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the talking therapies, mm-hmm. there's the medication, there's the being open and honest to other people and sharing your burdens with other people, which is just common wisdom that we would want to embrace and endorse. And mm-hmm. If people need that sort of help, they need to get that sort of help. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, what does Jesus offer to you?
So I think when you really spend time wrestling with this, it's difficult not to get beyond the kind of the helpful but superficial remedies, analgesics of medicine, of counseling, of community and friends, and I think what really sits behind mental health challenges, including anxiety and depression, I think you very quickly, if you're really going to think about it, then you very quickly get to questions of identity and what drives you, and I suppose what drives anxiety. I can say for myself, what drives my anxiety and sense of depression is fear, and that fear it can trace back to my identity, and I think even secular literature will kind of will say that actually, if you're going to really get into things, then questions of identity and sources of what are the sources of your behaviour, that is what really leads to change.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading a Harvard Business Review article, which is a totally secular piece of literature, which says exactly that. So I've forgotten the question.
What is it that's really helping? So these questions of identity are there. Who am I really?
Yeah.
And how important is that to me? How important is it to how I see myself? And Jesus helps with that, I guess.
Thank you. Okay, so how does Jesus help with questions of identity, and what difference does that make to anxiety and depression? Well, I guess four things, and it's much more foundation. It's not a quick fix. I know I keep saying that, but it's not. It's foundational. It kind of transcends everything in my life. It's not kind of it's not just related to anxiety and depression. It's related to everything. Jesus created me, so he made me. The Bible says he knit me together in my mother's womb, and so if he did knit me together in my mother's womb, then he knows me, and he understands me. Jesus is in control, so he made me, he knows me, he's in control. We see evidence of that in the Bible in many different ways, in his control that he has over death, in control that he has over the elements, weather, control that he has over people's health. But he's in control. So he made me. He knows me. He's in control. He loves me. And we see that in the Bible on the cross. And he's good. We see that countless times through the Bible. So a relationship with Jesus where he was just kind of in control. Not so helpful. I'd go back to my question. Well, okay, if you're in control, then flipping well, sort out my anxiety because I didn't ask for it and I don't want it. Thank you very much. But if he is not only in control, but he is, but he's good and he loves me and he understands me, then okay, all right, I'll listen.
Yeah, you can trust him.
Yeah, there's hope.
There's hope.
There's hope. Yes.
Yeah. So tonight there are people here. Some of them will be struggling with anxiety and depression, and some of them won't be. For those who are struggling with anxiety and depression, what kind of practical helps do you think they can access in terms of next steps?
I would counsel to accept the feelings of anxiety and or depression for what they are, to not deny, like I did, that there was anything wrong, and to go and get help, go and get practical help, go and talk to a doctor, or talk to a friend, or talk to a counsellor. And do that without shame or fear.
And even take a friend with you to the GP.
Perfect.
And if you know,
yeah,
if your friend can talk for you, your friend can talk for you. But yeah, go together.
Yeah,
get that help. See where they refer you.
Yeah,
yeah. And take whatever help's coming.
Yeah.
And then spiritually speaking, whether we personally struggle with anxiety and depression or not, if someone wanted to investigate this Jesus that you're talking about, what would you advise them?
Open up the Bible. A lot of people might have discounted Jesus or Christianity without necessarily having opened the Bible and perhaps read one of the Gospels, so one of the short books that talk about Jesus' life. So read one of those and go and talk to a friend who does know Jesus or believe in Jesus. Come to a church like this where they teach the Bible. They talk openly from the Bible, and explore the evidence. Don't leave your brain at the door. Keep your brain intact and look at the evidence and weigh it up and decide.
Great. And just look, final question: aged 18, there you were in Bristol, keeping Jesus at arm's length. So that's a very distant picture of who is Jesus. Who is Jesus to Ed Watson today?
He's my Lord and my Savior, which is quite a churchy way of describing it. So he is the King. He made me, and so he's King, Lord, and he's my Savior because he died for me, because of him, I know that everything will be okay.
Right.
So, yeah.
Right. That's awesome. That's awesome. Ed, tonight you have you've fought back against the darkness in the bravest way imaginable. You've let the light in and you've cast light out there, and you've let people know whatever dark valley they're walking through, they're not alone. You've done a lot of good tonight, and I think you're incredibly brave. I think tonight has been very significant, and I thank God for you. And I'd really love if we could all give a huge round of applause and thank Ed Watson.